Welcome to Things I Wish I Knew, the podcast from Thinking Faith, a work of the Jesuits in Britain. I'm Julia, I'm in my early 30s, and I used to live in a Jesuit young adult community. We all live hectic lives and often don't get time to reflect on what's happening both to us and around us. This podcast is meant to help you take a moment to stop and think about where you are, where you're going, and where your relationship with God fits into it all. Every week, I meet a new guest who tells me about something they experienced which changed their life forever. And by talking about the things they wish they'd known at the time, we'll explore the idea that God is in all things, and we'll talk about the part that faith plays in navigating life's challenges. So today, I'm speaking to Nigel, who just before lockdown made the decision to adopt his son. He's of Welsh heritage, he's a church leader, and is now working for Westminster Theological Centre. Today he speaks about the process of adopting, the infertility experience he had, and how he felt God's presence in it all. I love talking to him because his story is so powerful and so beautiful. It really impacted me, especially when he shared the joys and challenges of adopting. So Nigel, what made you decide to adopt your son?
It was a very long journey. We'd gone through a very difficult period of time in life, and I was walking down Southend on Sea seafront, and really wrestling with God about family and what does it mean to be family. Because we all, don't we? We have this 2.4 children biological understanding of family in Western culture in particular. Whereas family in the Bible and family in many other cultures is completely different. And for me, I think I was in a process of getting my system, both intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, mentally, really shaken around what it meant to be family. And so my wife and I had sort of talked about adopting. And I just remember thinking to myself, in all honesty, I don't want somebody else's child. That's the really selfish thing to confess, but it is where my heart was at that particular moment. And I remember walking down Southend seafront, as I'd mentioned before, and I heard this voice in my head around adoption, you know, just what would we call it? A sort of maybe a leading of the Holy Spirit. And I confessed that out of my mouth, well, I don't want somebody else's child. And then I just heard this inner voice say to me, but you're adopted. And I thought, no, I'm not. I have biological parents who I've had all my life. And I just really, again, this heart voice say to me, yeah, I adopted you. You're my son. And something just radically changed in my mindset. I thought, oh my goodness, I've got this really narrow view of family. And there's something much bigger, a bigger revelation of not just for me as a sort of an adoptive parent, but also in my theology and my understanding of God, which I'm sure we'll get onto at some point. But that was kind of like where I would say the light bulb, the Damascus Road moment, the light bulb moment came on, where I thought, oh, this is something much bigger than, you know, what I thought it to be.
I was just thinking about this, and I hope you don't think I'm being rude by saying this, but did you almost have to get over your own ego about where you thought your biological children needed to come from?
Yes. You do. I think you have to have every part of you shaken, really, right? And so the whole process of getting to that point was an understanding or coming to terms with what we didn't have. And I think, you know, for years when you are wrestling with things like infertility and you are facing up to what you don't have, especially when all your friends, you know, are on number two and number three, and you're thinking to yourself, when's number one going to come? And in faith communities, it can often be the worst place to wrestle with certain things. Like, you know, I've talked to my single friends who, like, really don't like being in church and being single because people have this worldview. Or, you know, if you're struggling with infertility, you know, it's like God's got good plans for you. You get lots of Bible thrown at you out of context. You know, I remember the amount of times people quoted Jeremiah 29:11 to me, you know, about God's got good plans for you. And being a bit of a sort of, I would call myself a theologian, but I'm a studier of the Bible. I had to remind them that the context of that verse was people in exile. So, and actually they didn't get yes as an answer. They got no, you're not going back to Jerusalem. You're staying in Babylon and you're going to build gardens and grow your families and things like that. So in many ways, I think just growing up in the church heritage I grew up in, there was a worldview. And when your worldview doesn't match up with that, you then really have a lot of soul searching. And if your ego isn't bruised by that or shaken or questioned, then I don't know what kind of process you're going through.
So I know what makes your story different is the fact that you had to make your decision quite quickly.
Yes.
Because you adopted just before lockdown.
Yes, that's right.
And so what made you decide to adopt at that time?
Yeah. Well, the adoption process goes on for around about 12 to 14 months. It's quicker now than it ever was. And our panel was sort of in the October of 2019. So we got approved, but we got matched pretty much before panel, if truth be told. They found this little boy with blonde hair, also Welsh heritage. And I remember just in my heart looking at his photo and thinking, that's my son. And I really felt even God's voice to me say, go get him, you know, go, you know. In some ways, it was like, it wasn't even rescue, but it was, you know, he's my son, go get him. You know, he's your son, but he's my son, go get him, redeem him, bring him back. And there was this real sort of sense of call about it, as well as the all the other emotions that go with it. And so we got to January 2020 and the transition process was approved, and that was going to be late February, early March. And no one had really heard about COVID. Can I say that without any necks creaking as people are listening? You know, COVID-19 or what, a coronavirus. And then when we started our transition in early March, second week of March, which was like, oh, even mid-March, March 12th, 13th, I'm really terrible with times.
I think we went into lockdown around the 24th of March, something.
Yes, that's around
then.
About right. So we had literally only just started the process of transition, and it normally takes about 5 or 6 weeks. I'd had extended leave from work, and my wife did as well. And so we were, you know, in Wales, in a place called Newport, ready to do this. And we were watching the news from about the 13th or 14th every morning, growing more and more concerned because now it was happening where we were. And one of the buzz spots of COVID in the very early days was Newport in South Wales. Okay. So there were all these hotspots emerging, and my wife and I just thought, oh my goodness, like, is this going to affect anything? So the social workers called an emergency meeting with us on, I think it was the Thursday before lockdown hit, which was the following Monday, and they said, right, we know you've only met him once or twice, but basically there's going to be a national lockdown coming into effect next week. So you either take him home with you tomorrow morning or this is going to be put on hold. Wow. And so we had one night, literally. I mean, me, you know, the guy with all the boxes where I thought, oh, you know, I can at least... We've got another couple of weeks of, like, tiny bit of peace and quiet. That was what I was thinking in my head, like, oh, it's okay, it's all fine. Then all of a sudden it was this realization of it's tomorrow.
And how do you make that decision?
I think you go back to that heart call again of, without sounding too pious, has God spoken to us about this? Why are we here? Like, why are we even, if we're not going to do this, why are we even involved in this transition? Has God always meant for this boy and these two grown-ups to be a family? And we were convinced that that was the case. So in many ways, we knew the answer. It just took, you know, just breathing. Going away and breathing. In some ways, it was more about like, oh my goodness, this is really not panning out the way we thought. Because then we realized that it wouldn't just be yes to it and going much earlier, but in really, really weird circumstances that all of us had not experienced in all of our lives before. So for us, it wasn't just lockdown. It was lockdown with a little three-year-old who didn't know us and we didn't know him.
I was just thinking that as you were describing, that must have been a massive transition for all of you. And I mean, we all had our own lockdown experience, but yours was like, sounds like it was layer on layer of complication and challenges.
I didn't know what hit me. I thought I was tired before, and I could hear all my friends who'd had children laughing in the background. But, you know, yeah, it really was. It was a new world. So we could, you know, we were stuck in our houses, all of us, weren't we? And we could go out for an hour every day. And this little boy who'd had a really unbelievably difficult start to his life suddenly found himself in a strange home again, thinking, who are these two adults? How are they gonna treat me? What is this? And so it was a super, super challenging. I can't really put any glitter on it.
I was just thinking, because from what I've heard of adoption, quite often the child has had experiences where they've had a person in their life who's then disappeared and things. So your son must have had that, are they going to disappear on me? But then instead you were there all the time.
Yes. He was probably thinking, when am I going to get some space? Well, they did an exercise when we did adoption training where all the potential adoptive parents were holding pieces of string, all the different parts of it. And then they were saying, when a child moves, what do they lose from where they were before? And you cut a piece of string, you know, whether it's like foster parents, pets that were in the house, toys, clubs. And suddenly you go through it and all these pieces of string are just falling everywhere. And you're thinking, this is this little child's world, probably for the second or third time, and they're three, that even though in some ways the removal from the first place was for safety, he's still lost. He's still lost. You know, we can sometimes over-glorify the fact that, well, you know, it's great that they were rescued, but you can't take away from the fact that they lost something. So, you know, it was a real challenge. It was a real, real challenge. And we encountered lots of different behaviours, coping mechanisms, and were thankful for some of the training we had, the friends we had. We could FaceTime. But really, it was a journey that, and you can get all the advice you want, but you have to journey it together. Because that's where the healing comes. It's in that sort of organic moment of, I'm staring at this situation and it's really awful, messy, awkward, painful, but I've got to be there in the moment with this little one. And that's really, for me, the kingdom of God.
Wow. I was just thinking, it's now been 5 years since COVID. How has life changed for you?
It really shows you how selfish you are initially. Like they always say, like, you know, oh, if you get married, you don't realize how selfish you are. But then when you have a child, I think it takes you to another level again. So it's that kind of thing of living a life where you are not just thinking of yourself. So I've got a very busy job that involves a lot of travel, and I literally I plan my travel around being at home. Or, oh gosh, I'm away the X amount of time here. Therefore, this child who has, you know, separation anxiety, really high levels. So every time I leave, he will ask me the question, are you coming back? And I've come back every time for 5 years, and he still asks me. All right, so this is why, you know, instantaneous healing is great, but for the majority of us, the truth is that healing is an everyday journey of putting one foot in front of the other. So every day he asks when I go away, are you coming back, Dad? Or when I'm away, we FaceTime and he sees where I am. He sees who I'm with. And it gives him a sense of security that, you know, oh, you're still here. You haven't like been raptured anywhere and, you know, you're coming back. So that's been a huge change. Cubs, play dates. Saturdays are normally my son and I going out, getting breakfast. I mean, you know, making it sound like it's across to bear, but a McDonald's breakfast. So, you know, it's not really helping my health fitness levels. But, you know, we get the sort of packet of fruit just to make us feel better as well in the options.
I'm sure there's a lot of running around.
There's a lot of running around. There's watching movies you would never dream of watching, like Clifford the Dog, which I can now repeat backwards. And it's the endless banter of, you know, your faults being pointed out to you mercilessly, really. So in that sense, life has radically changed. and I'm sure if my wife was here, she would give another nine ways of the way she sees it. But for me, life's changed quite radically. I'm trying to get him into sport now. I'm trying to, he's at that age where, you know, I'm trying to influence him, but, you know. We'll see.
Is he too cool
for
you?
He's way too cool for me. Apparently, the term these days is Sigma, right? He told me the other day, Dad, you're just not Sigma. And I thought, what on earth is Sigma? So I had to Google it and add an element of feeling what my dad probably felt like when I was coming home saying words that made no sense to him. So I'm not Sigma. There you go.
I mean, that's not a bad place to be.
It's not a bad place. Not a bad place.
So now in this time, does it feel like your heart was already always open to adoption, even if your brain wasn't?
No, it wasn't always open. There's two things I think from my tradition of church that we're really poor at, and that is to have a theology of waiting and a theology of suffering. I think there's other parts of the body of Christ who embrace that so much better than from my sort of evangelical charismatic traditions that I've grown up in. And I think that sort of this whole thing of just waiting and waiting for a pregnancy to come. Well, obviously, it was 11 years of infertility. And the reason why we held on to it was my wife had a dream early in our marriage of this blonde boy. And she came downstairs one morning and she said, I just had this dream of this little blonde boy sitting on my lap. And she said, I had never felt feelings like it. It was amazing. And we just saw that as a kind of a sign of, right, it's time to start a family. And 11 years later, nothing had happened, even probably longer than that. But we did fall pregnant on one occasion, but we lost our son during the pregnancy, and that was on our wedding anniversary that happened. So we were a little bit, I don't know if anyone else who's listening to this podcast ever gets a little bit angry with God. I think he's okay with that. I think he kind of, you know,
I've been angry with
yes.
God before.
I don't think he hasn't fallen off his throne yet anyway, as far as I can see. But we went through this whole waiting, and so what the process did was it brought me into a tension that I'd not embraced before, because for me it was always about you pray, you get a result, and you judge the impact on the result. You know, we treat God sometimes like a key performance indicator, don't we? You know, it's like, well, God, you know, these are the KPIs that I've set up. This is how I'm going to measure success of you leading me in my life. And when it doesn't all add up, you know, we are in that. And I don't think in big sections of the church we've created a really good biblical understanding of waiting is actually something that's part of the spiritual journey. And then on to this, what I would call a theology of suffering, because I resisted adoption for years. I just said, this is not for me, you know, God bless all the people who do it, and had that kind of quite arrogant attitude. But in the dark places of things not happening, I found myself just going into a deep, deep place with God. You know, we have our high moments and our low moments. And I think for me, I had to grieve losing a son. I had to grieve how it made me feel, how it made my wife feel. But Psalm 56, verse 8 is the verse that was a transitional verse for us, which said, you know, you have captured my tears in your bottle and recorded each one in your book. So every tear that I've shed, it's like God's captured it. He remembers our pain. And not so that we can consistently lament in our pain for the rest of our lives, because that's a danger, is we live from a place of pain for the rest of our lives. But that ultimately, he remembers it.
I was thinking about how when you were talking about in that time of sadness was when you felt closest to God, because I think in my life when things are going well, I find it just easy to be like, yeah, God, I'm grateful for you, thank you. And then, like, but when I'm in that time of sadness, that's when I actually turn to him and I like lay it down with him and have those conversations. So it's, it's a really powerful message to hear that from someone else who's had a similar experience.
It's you often find God in the crushing. It's hard to explain. I used to want to tell all my friends when things were going wrong that victory was round the corner. I don't know what kind of language we'd put to it, but, like, you know. And sometimes we want to run away from suffering. And who wants to embrace suffering? I mean, like, you know, that's not something you want to embrace. But I think sometimes we're so keen to, like, get out of the suffering zone. When something really deep's happening in there, I don't think it's God's will. I'm not saying that God puts us in those places, but I think these things happen and he meets us there. In the darkest moments, he meets us there. I think if I could just say this one little story. It was a morning where my wife and I had some really bad news, not just about infertility, but about something else that we were doing with family and having a family. And we were heading into London for a medical appointment, but it got cancelled, and it was just quite devastating. And so we walked down towards the Tower of London, and what we hadn't realised was this is how sort of not switched on we were at that particular moment in our lives. We didn't realise it was the London Marathon, and so we're walking down, going, "Oh, it's all the crowds!" And we got down, and we managed to get over to the riverside, and then they were saying, "Oh, you know, people are going to start running in a minute." So we got back up. So we were just trying to distract ourselves. We had a coffee in our hand and I was just completely numb. And all of a sudden, sort of the Paralympian athletes were coming past, and just watching them was stunning, really. I could see, like, groups of two running and I thought, they're not very competitive. Why are they keeping up pace with each other? That's really strange. I mean, that's where my head was at. I wasn't even able to analyse what was going on. And then all of a sudden I realised they were runners with impaired vision, and many of them completely blind, running this race. And when I looked at them, they were attached with rope to someone else. Mm. And again, it was that moment of hearing the voice in your heart. No, heavens didn't open. Somebody didn't come out with a harp and start singing. It was literally just a voice in my mind that said, and I really felt it was the Holy Spirit say to me, that's you and me. You can't see where you're going at the moment. Life is just feels abysmal. And you wonder how you're going to get to the finishing line. But you are, because you're connected to me. So... and I just felt like then permission to be okay that I didn't get it. I didn't have a good answer for all my questions. I didn't have all my healing for my pain. But something was emerging in the midst of all of that that is now morphing where we are now into a beautiful story of family and hospitality and things like that.
You say about it's now merging into a beautiful story. But if I'm being honest, I feel like it's always been a beautiful story. It's just, it's hard when you're going through those lows.
Yes.
I was also thinking about how your wife had that vision of the blonde boy. And you mentioned that your son has blonde hair.
Yes.
And I was thinking about, in my brain at least, God's timing of it. Mm. Because he knew it was going to take you those 11 years to get to a place where you were ready to adopt. And then your son would be there at that point.
Yes.
Because... if you'd gone any faster, you'd have been too soon for him.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you know, defining beautiful is more, in my head, I'm thinking about it feels beautiful. And it always was. And again, I think that's the earthiness of what we mean by that, you know, in our current age. He is genetically so similar to me, that poor guy. We do know a good plastic surgeon, so that's okay. But he looks very like me. And my parents were flabbergasted when they first met him, because when you look at photos of me at three and him at three, you know, we're like twins. It is really... And he's got the same personality as me. He can talk and talk and talk, and he's cheeky and makes people laugh, and he's, you know, he's light-hearted, and people love hanging out with him. You know, they don't see the other bits that I'm not mentioning on here, when it's when the trauma's really kicking in, because let's not paint a complete picture of like glorious radiance. But he is very much, I mean, I go into the park with him and people will go, wow, your son really looks like you. And I don't even think about him as my adopted son now. It doesn't even enter my head.
He's just your son.
He's my son. He's my son.
So what would you say to someone struggling with infertility or not sure about adoption?
What I would do to start with, which is the mistake I made, is I wouldn't lob them together. I think they're two separate paths.
As I was saying, yeah, I was thinking the first bit, what would you say to someone struggling with infertility?
Yeah.
And then we'll come back to the second part of the question.
Yes. But the reason why it's good to mention it is because most people do connect those things together. And I'm not saying that adoption isn't for everybody, but I think sometimes we act very quickly out of our place of pain, and it's been hard for some people. Some people have jumped from this infertility journey straight into adoption because what they want their child, and I understand that we all have a need to extend family inside of us, but it's as much if not more about the needs of the child, right? It's not that you're rescuing them, because they will bring something to your life that will be beyond rich, that, you know, in all of the, and again, you know, I've not gone into, you know, lots of the stuff that adoptive parents would be sitting there and thinking, yeah, we know what that's like at 3 a.m. Yeah, we've felt that pain and all the rest of it. It's all loaded together. So I think for people struggling with infertility, I would say, be prayerful about who you surround yourself with, because there's really well-meaning people who want the best for you and say things to you, and you just got to protect your heart a little bit. We had to be quite discerning about who we would talk to, and when people came with all this good encouragement to us, we were careful about what we let in. So I think there's an element of be wise, be discerning, and don't run from it. We didn't adopt for a good couple of years after we lost our son, and then we realized that was pretty much that journey's done, because we wanted to make sure we were doing it from the right place, and that took time. So I could say 20 things, but they would be the key things. Advice for people who want to adopt?
Yeah, unsure about adoption.
Unsure about adoption. Number one, I would encourage anyone to adopt. I mean, I would say pursue it, pray about it, don't just discard it.
I just want to add, I think adoption is one of the most beautiful things in this world.
It is. It is. Well, in many ways, and again, I don't have time to talk about it now, but I'm doing a lot of writing on adoption as a lost biblical narrative, because it's a narrative of the gospel we don't hear talked about. We just talk about decisions and salvation and, you know, but actually adoption is not just central to Paul's theology. It's found in Hebraic culture. It's just not called adoption. It comes out in different ways, but it's family, it's hospitality, it's the extension to the other. So adoption is an experience of the gospel of the kingdom of God. It's heaven in a moment on earth. If you look at the sort of, so adoption process, right? So we went looking for him. We found him. He came to our house with all the stuff that was kicking off them everywhere. We didn't throw him out. He spent time in our presence, started to become secure. Now he's starting to take on some of our mannerisms, like the way he takes, people say, oh, the way he tells a story, he's like you, and he uses his hands. And he said, it's hilarious because it's like me seeing you. So he starts to take on our DNA, our mannerisms. He's in our presence. He's becoming healed up. He's realizing that, oh, this is a safe place. Or maybe they are trustworthy mother and father. Then the judge rings up 9 months down the line and goes, just to let you know, this boy who's been in your house now, he's now legally got your name. So he has the legal right to all of your estate, everything. And I'm looking over at him with chocolate all over his face, his foot up like that, you know, picking his nose. And I'm thinking, what have you done to get into this position? Zilch. That's good news. That's good news. That's why the gospel of adoption is essential. And in this moment of our history, people everywhere need to know that there's a place at the table for them.
I'm blown away. Give me just a second. So if you're not sure about doing adoption, you said just do it.
Yeah, I suddenly realised I didn't really answer your question, did I? Yes, I think you should explore it. And I think sometimes people spend 10 years thinking about it. Don't spend 10 years thinking about it. And if you're not convinced, just take the next step, right? It's the psalm I quoted. Just take the next step. Some people have gone, they've gone through the training, they've got to the point where, we'll start looking and matching, and they've gone, I'm out. But you never know. You never know until you take the next step and the next step. And if you don't feel terrified, then you're not human. I felt complete and utter terror most of the time. I'm not going to, glorify it. Even to the point where when he came in my car and I drove him home, and when he walked into my house and he looked at me and I looked at him and we were like, right, we're going to be negotiating space here now, sunshine. You know, it was like, oh, how do I do this? But isn't that the life of every parent? Isn't that the life of every parent? When a child gets to this age, it's a new set of challenges when they get to that age. I hear parents talk and I think, actually, that's life. So if you felt something in you stir, go for it. If you are trying to rescue a child, don't let that be the only thing that's the driver, because sometimes we want to be the rescuers. But actually what that child will bring to you, yes, disappointment, pain, all the rest of it. Yes, absolutely. But there will be something deep, something rich. I mean, I walked my son to school this morning before I came here, and I've been away all week. And, you know, he lets me know when I've been away all week that that's not great. But we reconnected this morning, and he made me laugh all the way to school. Now, he was a nightmare to get out of the house. I mean, I was pulling my hair out, and there's not a lot of it. I was pulling my hair. We're going to be late. We're going to be late. Come on. You know, he's hopping down the stairs with one shoe on, you know.
That's an 8-year-old for you.
It's an 8-year-old. But then literally switched into this like comedy zone. And I suddenly dropped him off and thought, yeah, that's life. That's life. Do it. Go for it. You know, I think I read a statistic the other day. So I'm talking to the Christian community here. But I would love all people to do it. But to my Christian friends who are listening, if one family in every church in the UK adopted one child, there would be no social care crisis in this country.
Also blown my mind that. I can't get to my next question. It was too powerful a moment. So what do you wish you knew before stepping into adoption?
Do you know what? I'm going to really throw this on its head and say, I'm glad I didn't know the things I know now, because I wouldn't have done it. And I think that's part of learning. I think that's part of life. That's why God doesn't shine the street to you. He shines the feet to you. Because if you saw the street, you'd be like, when we get to that part of the road, I'm out. I don't want to do that. I mean, how many of us would be on the journeys we're on now if we saw the street at the beginning? You might get some really good, faithful, faith-filled people, pious people who say, oh, no, I am crucified with Christ and I always knew it was going to be like that. And I'm like, well, God bless you. You can pray for me regularly, because I would never have that amount of courage. So I think I've probably alluded to some of the things I would say to my previous self in the encouragement of if you're thinking of doing this or if you're wrestling with this. But I'm actually grateful that And if you said to me now, go and tell your previous self this, I'd say, I'd turn around to myself in the mirror and say, don't. Don't. Because this power in the growing, this power in the stretching, this power in the learning. So that's what I probably would say to myself is just make sure your foundations are solid. But I'm not, I would be very cheeky and say, but I'm not telling you anything else. You're going to have to learn.
I mean, that's the best story, right? Not when you can flip to the back and read the last pages when you're going through the journey. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Things I Wish I Knew. I know this episode is going to stay with me because the way Nigel shared his story. There were several moments in this episode where I had to stop and reflect on what he'd said, including the fact Nigel said about if one family in every church adopted one child, there wouldn't be a social care crisis. How about you? We'd love to hear about how Nigel's story resonated with you, and why not also tell us if you're facing an experience you wish you knew how to look at differently. It might just be something you can help with. You can find out more about this theme and others at thinkingfaith.org. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next time on Things I Wish I Knew.